Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust. Hey everyone, it's Jeremy Faust, the Medical Editor-in-Chief of ASAP Now and your host of ASAP Nowcast. Let's get right into May's issue. We're a little late. Sorry about that. I guess I'm going to make the COVID excuse as everyone is making. It's only going to last so long, I'm milking it for what it's worth. Headline, first page, love this article by Dr. Richard Levitan, who is probably known to many of you because he writes a column for us, but also he's just one of the great airway gurus of our time. He's taught so many people how to save the day in a tough airway, or as he might call it, a surgically inevitable airway if it's a crike or other situations. He's just one of those people that we love to hear from when it comes to troubleshooting the airway, which is the real estate that emergency physicians love to own, and we're good at it. But COVID-19 is a different kind of challenge, and I love that Dr. Levitan actually left his home in New England, and he came down to New York City to really be at one of the epicenters of this at Bellevue Hospital, where he really got involved. And as a result of that, Dr. Levitan was involved in a bunch of intubations, and who better to talk about that experience for those of us who maybe haven't had as many COVID-19 related intubations, who might in the future. So we put it on the front page, and let's just go through some of the major points that I think are super important, starting with position, with any procedure really, but intubation, we all know, position is so important. And we often think about positioning in a couple of different ways. We think about the patient, maybe the head of the bed could be elevated, and we think about maybe using a step stool to get over on top of that, and that's something that certainly we'll discuss. But one of the things that Levitan and people like him were really early in describing was the notion of proning. This is a simple observation that a patient who is hypoxic can have their oxygen saturation pop right back up just by getting them on their stomachs. And that is a nice, pretty much free intervention for a lot of our patients. But we'll come back to that. So the thing that we also need to know is what to do in terms of our early approach to helping oxygenate COVID-19 patients who are a bit hypoxic or even severely hypoxic. So you've got some positioning to do. You can sit them up straight and you can do the nasal cannula. In the article, there's a description of a bubble jet humidifier. I'll let you check that out rather than try to describe it here. And what Dr. Levitan also says is, look, you put them on nasal cannula and then you cover their mouth, maybe with a non-rebreather. This is actually really important. One of the reasons that nasal cannulas top out at the oxygen levels that they do is that it's kind of a mixture of air coming in, right? They breathe in through their mouths. That's 21% oxygen in the atmosphere. And there's the oxygen coming in through the wall, the nasal cannula, but you're mixing them up. If you have someone close their mouth, it's actually, nasal cannula can really deliver a lot more oxygen. The non-rebreather in this case, he's just saying, just put it over there like a mask. And essentially you're decreasing their aerosolization and you're also kind of covering up that admixture. That's a really great idea. And what they found in New York is that just by doing those things, they can really help a lot of patients maybe avoid intubation. Now, some of these maneuvers like proning are really going to be easier for skinnier patients. Obese patients, of course, they crunch their lungs really when they're sitting upright, so it can be really difficult. So there's some discussion as to what to do for them. Dr. Levitan has a really nice nonprofit he started to help get these mattresses to healthcare settings where you can help actually prone people by using these mattresses. Check that out as well. And the real thing, though, that I think is really interesting is Dr. Levitan's observations about what happens to these patients with COVID-19 that is so different than your typical patient who you are intubating. And one of the things that we've seen, and I've certainly seen this in my own practice, is that patients look okay, or even they look a little distressed, but their numbers, their oxygen saturation, their peripheral saturation is extraordinarily low compared to what you might have thought. You're looking at someone who's kind of looks a little short of breath and you don't think they're going to be satting at 81% with a good waveform, but that's what you see. And what you also find is they respond beautifully to oxygen. So you might put them on oxygen, but the second you disconnect them, for example, when you're going to the apneic phase of intubation, they are going to desaturate so quickly. So that is just an amazing thing that we see. And it's a part of what's making this disease just a little bit different than the things we're used to. So one of the things that Dr. Levitan says is in the patients who you have to intubate, certainly this is a very aerosolizing procedure. This is a danger to healthcare workers. This is where your PPE really matters greatly. Dr. Levitan has a little reminder acronym for himself, which is CRF4G. And that's hard to remember, so just say it like 10 times fast. CRF4G. CRF4G. Just get it in your head because it's cap, respirator, full face shield, base layer of gloves and gown, top layer of gloves and gown, and basically that's it. So it's the cap, the respirator, the full face shield, and the four layers of gowns and gloves. He doubles them up. And that is some intense PPE right there. And then he says that when you're done in the room, you shed the top layer, you actually wash the base layer of your gloves, and then go someplace out and get rid of it. So it's really, he's really taking the PPE to an intense level. But I get it because this is a very contagious disease, especially in people who are sick enough to need intubation. We know these folks have tons of virus that they're shedding. So now we get into some of the mechanics here. Dr. Levitan says that he really does feel that sitting the patients upright is the best way, using CPAP if you're able to. A lot of places are not allowing that. And he uses a viral filter with PEEP, positive end expiratory pressure valve, on the bag valve mask. And what he is using is KROC, ketamine and rocuronium. And the ketamine is at 1.5 mgs per kg, which is a little higher, I think, 1.5 mgs per kg than a lot of people give. And the rocuronium at 2 mgs per kg, that is a big dose. But I think that what we know from a lot of studies, if anything, rocuronium tends to be underdosed. Now, this is really important because people are talking about the idea of succinyl choline as opposed to ROC because of the faster onset. But Levitan thinks that the higher doses, the onset times are pretty comparable. And to be honest, you know, the real issue is sedation. They're going to be chewing through sedation. And the reason for this is that these patients are not your typical intubations. The people we tend to intubate, think of who they are. They are very sick persons. They are coming from, maybe they're unconscious because of trauma, or maybe they're coming from a nursing home, or they have really deteriorating underlying causes. They are not you and me sitting at work one day and intubated the next. And that, of course, that happens. But that's not the most of the intubations you and I do, I think. And so what he's pointing out is these patients in COVID are not encephalopathic from their acute hypoxia. They don't have hypercarbia like some of your other respiratory arrests that you see, and they're not really in shock with poor perfusion to the brain. So that's why you really have to give them a lot of sedation. And what I'm doing and what Levitan is saying is to really have a lot of agents at the bedside ahead of time. You can't be asking people to run around and get these meds when you need them this second. And we are going to see, Levitan says, really maybe a post-traumatic stress disorder related to this, because folks who really are young and healthy and who have a lot of fight or flight in them are going to remember this when they are through this, assuming that they survive, which we hope they do. So it's really very important that we adequately sedate these folks. And in terms of tube placement, for one thing, he's saying don't use stethoscopes. It's just too unreliable. And of course, the chest x-rays can be very challenging to get immediately, especially with moving them around. So of course, if you can do a quantitative CO2 detector, that's always good, the end title. The other thing I'm going to say is that this article really digs into some Levitan goodness. But he says, go slow, go smooth. It's so easy to panic and to say, I got to get there faster. In my experience, watching these patients desaturate quickly is unnerving, but they also resaturate quickly. What you're seeing on the pulse ox is not central oxygen. This is their fingers. They're clamping down. And I think that's borne out by the fact that usually when I intubate a patient and they're desatting in the 70s or 60s or lower, if that's a good waveform, they are pretty unstable with respect to bradying down with their heart rate or having a low blood pressure. These COVID folks, though, can be really low in their oxygen saturations and be rock solid stable otherwise. So it's easy to get worried, but it's important to know this is going to happen and to get through the procedure. He talks a little bit about what to do if you're failing, whether you should use a glide scope or other hyperangulated blades or not, what to do in terms of first pass success failure. And he is really, as always, really enlightening. So check that out on the front cover of the May issue of ASAP Now. And let's move on to another topic. Next up is a really important topic. I'm really glad we have this in the magazine. The title of the article is COVID-19 While Black, and it's by Dr. Janice Baker. And Dr. Baker is one of the curators of the Equity Equation, which is one of our recurring columns in ASAP Now. This article is really timely. It was actually written back in April or March and April, but it's just become more and more relevant in the past few weeks. It's all about the unequal impact that COVID-19 has had, particularly on Black communities, as has been the case with so many medical problems. This is not the first time we've seen this, just happening yet again. And Dr. Baker notices that she's got friends and parents of friends and childhood neighbors and cousins who've died from COVID-19, maybe out of proportion to what the average person should. And the question is there a racial or sort of a racism in healthcare component to this? And I think the answer has got to be yes. So we know that SARS-CoV-2 risk factors for very bad illness include things like obesity, lung disease, diabetes, hypertension, and other conditions, and that minorities, Black communities in the U.S. are known to disproportionately have higher rates of these. And it's not just a genetic thing. It's a matter of health care and follow-up, and it's just really a systemic issue. And in this article, back in April, we even saw already that, according to Johns Hopkins, African Americans were 3 times more likely to have SARS-CoV-2 and 6 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than any other racial group. And in the intervening period, we've gotten much more data. We've seen stuff out of Georgia and out of Louisiana, for example, where you see that the African American Black population is around 30% of the population in Louisiana, and yet these individuals are actually over 70% of the deaths from COVID-19 and also over 70% of the hospitalizations. Seems like once people get to the hospital, the care for COVID is not too different, which I suppose is reassuring from an ER perspective, emergency medicine perspective, and a hospital perspective, but it's very concerning from a sort of healthcare perspective. To me, this means that we're seeing the playing out of long-term lack of healthcare in our communities play out in a very critical setting such as COVID-19. So this is really a call to action to say, hey, there's a reason why primary care and long-term stuff matters, because when things like this happen, well, who do you think suffers the most? And Dr. Baker points out that health informatics can really help clinical care, and we can find more about our patients through looking at complete health records and those kinds of things. And It's truly amazing that we're seeing this play out sort of one patient at a time, but at the same time, what Dr. Baker does in this article is really point out that emergency medicine is very well positioned, uniquely positioned, she says, to spearhead health disparity research. And the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities is now issuing a special notice to say that we need to look at this. And there's really a great opportunity, not just for healthcare, but particularly for emergency medicine researchers and healthcare workers to get in on this and make our communities more healthy. And it's really time that we did this. It's not just that we need to get people primary care. That's part of it, sure. But it's also really about understanding racism as it plays out in medical settings. Let's be very honest about this, because Dr. Baker is. She writes that if you look back at the Tuskegee syphilis study, for example, think about that and how the mistrust in the medical system that must still exist from episodes like that in our country's history, which are not isolated, and they really do cast a long shadow. We need to find a way to address that mistrust so that minority patients can come to the doctor, can come to the emergency department, can interact with the system that we have and not feel like second-class citizens, or not feel like they're not going to get the best treatment. There is mistrust that is, quite frankly, earned by maybe past generations, but also to some extent present generations who haven't done enough to correct that. And so we've got to correct that now, because we now see really in a very like time-lapsed way how critical this can be. It's one thing to sort of say, yeah, it's sort of over a long period of time these things crop up, and we see that the life expectancy is a month or two or a year or two, or and sometimes much more than that for certain groups. And you can, as emergency doctors, we sort of say, well, that's not really my problem. That's the primary care's problem. That's, I can't do much about that. But when you think about where it all begins, which is the patient encounter, I think we do have a contribution to make. And I think that's what this article is really about. It's about inspiring us to be a part of the solution, even if we may not feel like we're part of the problem, we may not realize that we have been. And so that's okay. Let's just acknowledge that and commit to being part of the process that makes it better for all of our communities, really, truly. All right, let's cover a couple more things in the May issue of the magazine. I was very honored to do an interview with ASAP's president, Dr. William Jaquess, to discuss how things have been going, both during his tenure before and also during COVID. And I'll just focus in on just the one question. The rest of it you could read in the magazine, in print or online. And I really wanted to know from Dr. Jaquess's perspective how ASAP has really made a difference in the COVID moment. And he mentions a lot of things that ASAP has done at the CDC level, HHS level, CMS, Joint Commission. And one of the big wins really has been telemedicine. This allows us to be separate from people who are infected, and we can save our PPE. Of course, going forward, we've got the issue of payments. We have seen a huge drop in volume during this crisis, and we need to make that up. So ASAP and Dr. Jaquess are working on looking at payment methodologies there so we can stay afloat. It's good to know that they're on top of this. Really interesting interview, I think, and I hope you'll check that out. The next piece that I wanted to cover real briefly was an article about Get Us PPE. This is a really important initiative of which I should mention I am a part of. And this initiative was founded by Dr. Valerie Griffith, Dr. Shuhan He, and Dr. Megan Ranney. These are friends of mine, I should acknowledge. And basically what it came down to was that Esther Chu, of course, it always comes down to Dr. Esther Chu. She's an ER doc out in Oregon, who I'm sure a lot of you know about. Esther can make things happen. And she tweeted about the idea of get me PPE. And it just took off. And people like Dr. Ranney, Dr. He, and Dr. Griffith really ran with this. And the idea is to match PPE needs with PPE donors, because there is really, as we all know, a lack of PPE in certain areas. So they started to hear, oh, you know, there's some companies and some industries that aren't using their PPE during the shutdown, and they want to donate it to a hospital, but how does that happen? And so this becomes a logistical issue. So it almost became like a matchmaking for PPE donors and PPE recipients. And it's just been a very inspiring story to watch play out. And Dr. Ranney in particular went on to speak before the Congress, the House Subcommittee on Coronavirus, to discuss these issues, really representing emergency medicine extremely well, as always. Elsewhere in the magazine, we have some pretty great information. The ASAP for You space, which is written by our ASAP staff professionals, we have seen just some really great work. I'm so proud of this organization. For example, we had a policy priority to enact temporary liability protections for the duration of the pandemic. This idea has really taken off. I wrote about it way back when, and ASAP really took it seriously. They had the idea, I'm sure, without me, but I was happy to chime in. The American Medical Association has now drafted language, which is now being used by Congress in a bipartisan legislation to expand these kinds of practices to the extent that it's possible under the federal system. And it's just really nice to know that people have our backs when we are putting ourselves on the line, front line. You know, we're all doing this, and a lot of people are giving some really wonderful words to that experience. So I encourage you to check those articles out in print and online. Now, lest you think that the magazine is only COVID all the time, I mean, for May, I think we gave a lot of coverage to COVID, which I think made a lot of sense. But we also did try to make some room to make sure that we covered some other things. We've got our By the Numbers, which is our usual feature column space that we give to just a quick snapshot of something going on in the country. In this case, we covered bicycle injuries, which is a pretty important area. In 2018, 857 bicyclists were killed in the U.S., which is a little bit of an increase. And we know that men, of course, are the the ones who are the most at risk of this. I don't know if it's because men don't wear their helmets. I'm sure someone will answer that question immediately when I say this in the podcast. But for more of that, check it out. I love this space because it's sort of like, kind of like when you open up the paper and see one of those infographics. We like to do those too, just to keep you up to speed on a topic that you might get asked about. I think that people are interested in knowing about bike safety, so we covered that this month. We also had a nice article written by one of our regulars, the one and only Dr. Ken Mill, or some of you know him from the SGEM, the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. And he is writing about a new study comparing point-of-care ultrasound with x-ray for shoulder dislocations. So that's pretty interesting. I have tried that. I have never done it in a way that made me not do the x-ray, I have to admit, but I have certainly used it as a way to say, am I ready for that x-ray? And you should go through, because as Dr. Mill always does, a very careful evidence-based commentary where it goes through every part of what you want to look at when looking at a study, and you get to a bottom line, in this case, that x-rays probably should continue to be the primary imaging modality for dislocations in terms of this, in terms of reductions and in terms of diagnosis. So this is an important thing, though, because we want to make sure we stay up on the evidence, but we also want to make sure that we don't get ahead of ourselves. Dr. Milne, just the way he approaches things is just so rigorous, and it's a way of thinking. It's not, you don't just learn a fact, you learn how to learn, and that's the best education out there, which is why Dr. Milne is an award-winning, a national award-winning medical educator, and he is just one of our amazing ongoing columnists for ASAP Now. Thanks so much to our columnists, to our teams who make this all happen, and to you all for continuing to represent emergency medicine on the front line, in the media, in writing. In whatever way you're contributing, I know that we all feel a tremendous sense of pride in this moment, and I'm proud to be an emergency physician, and I imagine most of you, all of us, feel the same way. So this is a scary moment for everybody, but it's also a proud one because this is why we do what we do. Okay, see you next time on ASAP Nowcast. Be well, be safe, take care.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.